One in five Americans has learned a new language on their bucket list, or life backlog, if you will. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off the list with Babbel. Upgrade your personal skill set in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Its tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and deliver with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I have a trip to Mexico coming up, so I've been using Babbel to brush up on my Spanish. The courses are short and sweet, so I can do one whenever I have a few minutes to spare. And the words and phrases it teaches you are designed for practical, real-world use, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions. Babbel can even provide you feedback on your pronunciation with its speech recognition tech. And it's not just for Spanish. Babbel includes 14 different language courses, each backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for Scoop Nation. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/gamescoop. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/gamescoop, spelled BABBEL.com/gamescoop. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hey listeners, let's take a moment for a shout out to our sponsor, Squarespace. This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform for creators to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create an awesome website, connect with your audience, and sell anything all in one place, all on your terms. Even if you don't know where to start with creating a website, Squarespace has you covered with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. Choose from professionally created layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business, and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people. Flexible payment options make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accept credit cards, PayPal and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So, ready to get started? Head over to squarespace.com/gamescoop for a free trial. And when it's showtime, use our special promo code GAMESCOOP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Now, let's dive back into GAMESCOOP. What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GAMESCOOP. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week are Tina Amini.
Hi, everybody.
Sam Claiborne.
Hey, over there, everybody.
And Justin Davis.
Scoop.
We've got a great show for you this week. Justin has a great new camera setup. It's looking really clear for everyone that's watching the video version of the show. We're going to revisit our homework question from last week about movie sequels and game sequels and how...
Darn it! I forgot to do my homework.
One. All you had to do was think about it.
That's what my teachers always said.
Missed opportunity to say your cat ate your homework.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's start over. That's what happened.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. My name is Damon Hatfield.
We also have a couple email questions from a couple of our younger listeners. We've got questions from an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old that we're going to address. But first, Resident Evil Village, Resident Evil 8 is out. Oh, yeah. Several of us have been looking forward to it. I'm playing it. I assume Sam is playing it.
Heck yeah.
Is Tina playing it?
Hell yeah.
I know Justin doesn't like the spookies.
Oh, no, but I can tell you so much about Pokemon Snap.
Okay.
Really? Cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can also cover off on Pokemon Snap. But first, Resident Evil Village. I like it. I'm still in the castle. I have dealt with two of the vampire daughters. That's about where I am right now. Sam, how about you?
I am between you and Tina, then, because I am past that and I'm about to leave the castle.
Ooh, Tina is the furthest.
Yeah, apparently. I have a very important tip that I've already given Sam that I need to give you, Damon, before you leave the castle. Mm-hmm. Make sure, before you leave, when you're done, go everywhere and make sure all your rooms are blue and get the treasure, because when you leave, you will not be able to come back.
Oh,
and I
no.
did not know
oh,
that. Yeah. And I left some treasure behind, thinking that I would be able to, in my leisure, wander around and find that stuff. But no, so be careful.
Yeah,
games need to just accept the fourth wall break and be like, look, once you leave here, you're not going to be coming back ever for a long time. It's fine.
And they usually do that for big boss battles. Like, this is the point of no return, but why not in individual chapters?
Sam, this is relevant to your interests. I've actually looked, and I haven't found a good guide for turning the rooms blue. Yeah. And making sure you find all those items.
It's so funny. That is the thing I pitched at our guides meeting. I was like, just tell people how to turn the rooms blue.
How to turn the rooms blue.
Yeah, and that's so true. So we're actually doing that. I think it's going to be up today. But it's really funny because there are things that you need to do that, which you can't figure out when you're in there. Like, first you figure out, like, break all the bases, open all the drawers. That's the easy stuff.
Yeah.
But these darn crystals, you can shoot off the wall as an example. And there's other stuff too. And there's a big treasure in the dungeon of the castle that's totally optional that you can go down and get, but you have to fight a lot of enemies to get there and so forth.
Yeah, I fought a lot of enemies to get there, but I didn't have the right key at the time. And then I figured when I did get the right key, I was like, oh, I should go back and get that treasure. It was after I wrapped up all this other story stuff in the castle, and then it was done. I was locked out. So I went through all the enemies for no reason whatsoever. Other than my personal enjoyment.
And maybe you got some ammo drops to counter the ammo you spent.
Yeah, it never evens true. Out. Yeah. So, well, to answer your question, Damon, because I never actually did, I finished the castle, and then there's another section. I don't think this is a spoiler to say, because it was in the trailer as well, but some of the other, and you're introduced to them at the start of the game too, because you'll see a lot of the different enemies as a bit of a glimpse into it. So I went to another, let's call it mini boss, because there's like lords on the map and you have to individually target each of them. So I've gone to the affectionately known as Dollhouse, which was, so I have to say, vampires, scary, they're hunting you, the pressure, blah, 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 tension, all great, all scary, definitely had me creeped out. It does not compare to the dolls and the other things that I will not spoil that happened there. The one relief I will say is that it was a very short chapter, thankfully.
No, if you were to like stack rank spookies from like most spooky to least spooky, like creepy dolls,
one of the most up there.
Way higher than vampires.
Our guides team and a few other members of our staff are like kind of like into speedrunning this game right now and are kind of figuring that out. And the reason is like there's a reason to play the game over and over again. And the game seems to be kind of set up that way. And, you know, the negative spin on that is that it sounds kind of short. Like you can rip through it. Unlike Resident Evil 4, which goes on and on and on and on, which I really liked at the time, but it remains to be seen whether that pacing is something that like is actually enjoyable and pleasant to beat a game and maybe entices me to play again. I definitely played Remake 2 more than once. I played it 3 times.
Wow. Yeah, I think our own Mark Medina said he's beaten Village in 2 hours now.
But
it's not a 2 hour game. That's like his like sixth time through it, you know.
Yeah,
it's like a 7 to 10 hour game, let's say.
Okay.
I would
say. Yeah. Which is probably a little bit shorter than 7, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Because I played 7 to 10 hours of 7, never beat it, because I never got out of the main area. But I do like that, you know, that there is I like how Resident Evils do the Resident Evil experience. They're like, here's a mansion with puzzles. And then they expand on that. And they're like, do something different each time after that. And this game, just based on what Tina just said, like sounds like it goes in a different direction after that, which I'm excited for.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the next chapter, the doll stuff, they take a different approach to the gameplay in a way. I'm trying not to spoil too much, but basically it's a very different vibe in a lot of different ways. So the way that you survive in the dollhouse, it's not the dollhouse, I'm just using that as shorthand. The way that you survive in the dollhouse is very different than the kind of strategy and pacing in the vampire house, because you have to be on the lookout for a different kind of predator, let's say.
It's okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is not my style of game, so I'm not playing it, but I definitely respect and totally agree with their vision for like each different area is like a different flavor of like horror or like, you know, body horror, or like ghosts, or even gameplay, like more puzzly or more shooty or more actiony. Like, it's really clever. It's really smart.
They even go sci-fi in Resident Evil, which is kind of neat. It's usually by like the end of the game, you're in some like tech lab or something.
Laboratory.
I love that part of it. I love that progression.
Yeah.
Does the game look next gen to you guys?
Well, it's, you know, it's not technically a next gen game, right? But
yeah,
it does look very nice, I think.
No comment for me, because I play on a projector, so anything I say is going to be down-resed by quite a bit.
Yeah. I haven't decided yet. Like, there's parts of it where I'm like, man, this chair looks amazing. Like there's textures and like just lighting and stuff like that, which look really cool.
I will say you can tell which characters they really spent their time on with their animation. Like all the Vampire Daughters, like their animation is like amazing, but then some random villagers in town, they don't look so great.
Oh yeah. The fodder enemies, who cares about them? Yeah.
That's like, that's like cyberpunk syndrome too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a sillier Resident Evil, right? It's a little bit sillier.
Man, it's hard to tell. Resident Evil's been silly this whole time. And people take it seriously when they're young. And then, like, you know, it becomes this big lore thing. But, like, you go back, you know, these games don't take themselves seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the writing, the acting, like all those things are a little notorious. Like, there'll be moments where you know, like there's different levels of ha-ha-has, right? Like, there's that that meme from ages ago where, like, each of the additional ha's mean different things. And so I'll do the singular ha. The, like, ha out of nowhere because something, like, caught me off guard. Like, I'm in this really tense environment and I'm terrified. And then Ethan says something ridiculous and it just it cuts the tension a little bit in a nice comedic relief way.
Yep. Yeah. I guess like, those one-liners, those action movie one-liners, just that exact thing you're talking about, that tension. It's like, in this game, like, the premise is really dark. Things get darker. Things go really wrong for the protagonist. And then, like, you know, he'll, like, clean out the kitchen of vampires and be like, I should have ordered out.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff like that.
Well, it's also, like, he's just a dude. Like, he's not some super soldier. Yeah.
That we know of. I mean, like, everybody knows him so far. It's just, like, everybody's like, oh, like, you know, wasn't he Ethan something Carter?
Ethan Winters.
Winters? Yeah. They're just like, they're always like being like, Ethan, I've heard so much about you. And it's just like, okay, a vampire in Romania? Wherever they are.
There's spoilery stuff from the end of 7, right? Which I don't play these things, so it's like I read the story spoilers.
One I need to read, actually.
Probably.
And I think a little bit of like 8 context, too, where he matters to them for reasons.
Mm-hmm. Reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently this is explained, but the amount and this a lot of people have talked about this, but the amount of damage that happens to Ethan's hands is insane, and he's able to still like hold a gun and shoot. Apparently that's explained eventually, but
there's something towards the end that I'm obviously not at to understand that stuff, but I guess what it comes down to is you see his hands most prominently as the player. Yeah. So that your connection to Ethan is through his hands. And if you're playing a horror game with a bunch of gore, that's the best visual that you can get unless they, in a cutscene, like zoom out to the third person perspective. But that doesn't happen. So you need that impact, that visual impact.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And boy, is it impactful.
Yeah. You can't do the body horror on other parts of their body that aren't like visible all the time. Yeah. So that makes sense.
Like, looks down and there's like a large intestine hanging out and he has to push it back in and pour fluid on it.
I didn't even know my intestine was hanging out.
Oh, look at this guy.
Oh God. There's a, the explanation that we have so far in the game is not in any way a spoiler. It's that those green herbs, they fix anything.
Yeah. Just pour it in. Whatever the juice is, just pour it over your hands and you'll be fine. Yeah,
exactly.
I took a page out of a mini playbook and I took some notes on my phone while I was playing.
Oh. Positive influence.
So when the game opens, this isn't a spoiler. Ethan and his wife have relocated to Romania, right? That's where they are supposed to be?
I think they just say Europe. I made up Romania. Mm.
Could go wrong?
Yeah. But so, and they have a daughter now. And so the first thing you have to do is put your daughter to bed. So you have to take her upstairs and they have the crib in the master bedroom of this house that they're renting. Do you guys notice the master bedroom does not have a bathroom?
What?
No, the bathroom's down the hall.
You gotta have a bathroom in your owner's suite.
Everyone knows makes that. It the master.
How exactly.
Spoken like people who didn't grow up in New York, where these are luxuries.
I don't know. It's a big house, but no bathroom.
Yeah,
in the,
it is weird for a big house.
Master bedroom. Now, I want to talk about something, but do you guys think it's a spoiler? The catalyzing event that happens right at the beginning. Do you think that's a spoiler, even though it happens in like the first few minutes?
Why don't we tell the Game Scoop listeners, if they care about it, they can skip exactly 2 minutes ahead.
Okay. Skip 2 minutes ahead. This happens in the first minutes of the game, so I don't think it's that huge a spoiler. But here we go. Ethan's wife is brutally gunned down right away. He has very little reaction to it. I think
because there's green herbs in this world.
I think he calls her name once and then that's it. That's it. Never to mention her again, at least as far as I've experienced.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. Seven was very prominently focused on her. And then eight now, effectively, like there are moments where references come back. But obviously, you know, given that your family has expanded, your priorities have changed as this new version of Ethan. So I guess that's kind of the explanation, because he does go, like, you know, looking for solutions in the cult. I'm navigating spoilers here, but like he is like looking for some sort of resolution. So he cares in the sense that it's the driving factor to him going about this mess of going into vampire houses and doll houses and whatnot. So I suppose that's where the reaction is coming from ultimately. Yeah. That's what his reaction is.
Games definitely have to strike a balance between, like, it's the inciting incident, right? And so then they got to get on with it. Like, the game has to start. You can't have him gnashing his teeth and wailing for, you know, weeks and months and months, as any, like, normal person would be in real life, right?
Yeah,
but it's like, we just got to go. The game's got to start.
That's true.
Maybe some of that happened off screen.
Yeah, exactly. 3 years later, you're like, that's what they needed. That one black slide with the white text over it. Although there have been games, I can't remember exactly which ones right now, but there have been games that have explored the pacing of that in a little bit of a different way, where you get a chance to do some side quests while you have moments. Like, actually, Cyberpunk is a bit of an example, because you have a friend that dies in that game, and there are moments where you go on side quests that connect back to that friend and deepen that connection that you have, and then, you know, visit with his friends and his family, and then you kind of there are beats in across the game where he keeps coming back as relevant. So I think that kind of accomplishes making sure that the feelings feel real.
You know, God of War is about mourning, right? It's about why Kratos is super upset at losing his wife, and how he kind of takes it out on his kid, and it kind of works through a mourning process like that. And then Last of Us does the opposite. There's almost like a Last of Us Part Two. There's almost like a celebratory segment where it's like, "Ooh, at least, you know, we got through that all. We can just like live out our lives." And that's a false ending, you know, one of many.
Sure.
I think, by the way, I know we're not talking about God of War, but I have to say real quick, my favorite thing about that game is that the entire quest is just optional. Anytime, like, it's not like he gets pulled into this, like, world-saving thing. Anytime he wants to leave and walk away, be like, no, I'm not climbing this mountain. He can do that. Like, it's very different than other games in that way. It's like, he's choosing to go on this journey.
That's true. Yeah, he's not saving the world.
Nope.
A document you find early on which explains why these soldiers showed up at your house has their mission objectives. It says eliminate target, recover body, move the two Winterses to site C for further investigation. And I think if your last name sounds like it's plural already, it doesn't need to be Winterses. Whereas I could see moving the Davises, but the Winterses sounded really strange to me.
There's a grammatical, it's if the letter that precedes the S is a vowel or not. If it's a consonant or if it's a vowel, one of them is S apostrophe S, and then otherwise it's just S apostrophe.
You could still read that. Ugh, I don't even know.
Well, it's also not a possessive, because you're not saying like move the Winters' clothing into their new apartment. Like, so there's a bit of a difference there, but I see the description of, like, you know, the Winters family, which is just a solution.
I can just move the Winters.
That's a really good editor's trick that Tina just pointed out.
Yeah.
That, you know, if it sounds awkward, then just write a different way.
Just change it.
There's always a different way to write it.
Just add a word, buffer it.
And so, if you're writing an essay for school, then that added word's going to get you one word closer to that.
There you go. To your required word count. Yeah. This is fix those margins.
I never write affect or effect. I just don't write them. I know the rule, but I'm still not sure. And so I just change it to impact every time.
Oh, yeah, you got to have like little learning tricks for those. I have a dumb one. It works for my brain, so it helps me remember like which is the A and which is the E, and then it becomes reflexive.
Yeah.
Or you could just go with impact.
Yep.
I didn't realize that impact could work as both the noun and verb versions of those two words.
Right? Yeah.
I'm only
impact
I'm
something only, and I'm measuring only, the impact.
This is only like half a joke, by the way. Like, if you look at my writing, I probably use the word impact a lot.
It's impacts all the way down.
Welcome to Word Scoop.
Yeah, it's true.
So soon enough, you end up in the village, the titular village, and there were werewolves. But apparently, just a few days before, the werewolves weren't a problem, right? Oh. So there's just this village in, I think, Romania.
Isn't that unclear? Aren't they like, we've been protected from these, and that's why they're not worried?
Is that what it is?
You meet some like human villagers, yeah. And like, oh, but Mother Miranda's always protected us.
Yeah.
Which is what I want to point out. This village, they have their own religion here in this part of the world, and they have electricity, but they're living in a very like old world way. They don't seem to have internet, and they have their own religion, and everyone has an American accent and speaks English.
The American accent is really concerning to me. The rest of that is just standard, you know, movie cult stuff.
I guess so. Yeah. Do you guys like the Duke?
What's the Duke?
No. He's the merchant. Supposed to like any of them.
Oh, he's the merchant.
The merchant. Yeah, I think they're all supposed to be contemptible, first of all.
Yeah, they're all enemies.
Not the Duke.
I'm totally anticipating. I'm calling it that he's going to be like a surprise boss, mini boss at some point.
I mean, he's cartoonishly villain-like. He's horrible. It's like such a gross character.
He has a good reference to Resident Evil 4. Have you guys gotten that?
Yes, I've gotten him to say that once, where he says, what are you buying? Or something.
He goes, what are you buying? That's just something an old friend of mine used to say.
What? But then that has lore implications.
I know. Like, he's friends with the merchant from Resident Evil 4.
But Resident Evil 4 takes place in nondescript Europe.
Yeah.
But perfect.
Wasn't the merchant in Resident Evil 4 supernatural? Wasn't he like...
Well, this guy kind of is too. Because he'll be like, how are you here? That's just like an ongoing joke. Also, that we know it's a different country or there's been a regime change, because in Resident Evil 4... The gold you get is called pesetas. It's like a specific named currency. And in this game, it's just called something else.
I think it's called Lei. L-E-I, yeah. I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This scene, actually, that we're seeing right here, I thought was actually pretty scary. This is the werewolves in the fallow plot. Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah,
the fallow plot, like the graveyard. That was one of the scarier moments that I've encountered so far. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I thought the dungeon full of blood was pretty bad.
That's also pretty good. Yeah, although you would think after you emerged, you'd leave bloody footprints behind you. But
did you
don't.
Check? I checked.
Yeah, I checked. You don't.
Don't worry. Don't worry. Other things leave bloody footprints later.
Great. Ooh. I hope they're not dolls.
This Justin, is why every time I'm like, maybe I do want to play this, then you're talking about it. And I'm like, nope. I'm good.
Does anyone leave bloody footprints in Pokemon Snap? Yeah.
I haven't seen everything yet, so I can't say definitively. Mm-hmm. Take the answers.
You couldn't answer that for 20 questions.
Unlikely.
Damon say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Can neither confirm nor deny. No, Justin, are you playing Pokemon Snap as like a family affair?
Well, yeah. So I don't have any affinity. You know, I miss the Pokemon games. I keep saying I've never played a Pokemon game, but over the years, it's like, okay, I played Pokemon Go. I played Pokemon Snap. Like, they're building up over time. But anyway, yes, I bought it because I thought my daughters might like it. But then I personally got sucked into it, mainly because it's like the world. Nintendo's gotten so good at making chill out games. Mm-hmm. Like Animal Crossing last year and Pokemon this year were like, you're on a little tram and then it's on a pre-made track. And then you can look all around and take pictures of these Pokemon. But like that makes it such a perfect gameplay loop because it's like 4 minutes long and then you can just do it again and do it again. And so it lasts just the perfect length of time to be like, I think I'll do one more until, you know, my entire Switch's battery is run down. I don't have any, they make a huge deal out of some of these Pokemon. Like, I can't believe it's, you know, so-and-so. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. This doesn't mean anything to me at all. So I don't care about that part of it. But Nintendo threads that needle and walks that line of like, my 6-year-old likes it. And, you know, her 36-year-old dad likes it. So I don't think the game's like some amazing thing. Like, I'm not going to get all misty-eyed at seeing my favorite Pokemon that I've been, you know, friends with since I was a kid. Like, you know, like some other people are. They have that connection to that franchise. But I think it's fun. And I every time I played it, I ended up being hooked. And, I ran down my whole Switch's battery 2 or 3 times till I beat the game. So
you also get hooked in Resident Evil Village.
Oh, God.
Oh.
We need a little drum set for you, Damon.
I'll add it in post.
Is there a haunted area? Is there a haunted house you get ghost Pokemon in?
There are no ghost Pokemon, but this game.
There are no ghost Pokemon?
There may be some ghost types, but no. You go through different biomes. So you go through like a jungle and then a desert and then, you know.
Yeah, and ghost. Underwater. Ghost biome. Ghost house.
Yeah, no ghost house.
Wow.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe that is a little bit of a missed opportunity.
Well,
this is like when we combine Doom and Animal Crossing for having the same date, release date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't realize, maybe everyone else totally got this, but like, you know, stupid me never made the connection until I saw my daughter playing that. These are light gun games. Mm-hmm. It's a non-violent light gun game. You're playing Time Crisis or Resident Evil where like shit's popping out at you. Like a Pokemon pops out from behind a tree and you have like a second to take his picture before he's gone. And then I have this like light bulb moment where I'm like, this is exactly the same as Area 51, mm-hmm. but you're just taking their picture instead of shooting them in the head.
It's also like, just like Resident Evil 8 because it's a jump scare. jump scare.
It is. So maybe that's why they took the haunted house out.
It's non-lethal enforcers.
Yeah, it's that's really good, Dave.
Non-lethal enforcers. Well done.
Yeah, and so then, you know, my six-year-old has learned to, like, zoom. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's the same as aiming down the sights in a gun with holding down the left trigger, but you're zooming in on a camera. And I'm like, oh, this is weird. But, yeah, it totally works.
You're scoping out your shots before you kill them.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you catch
labeling your targets.
Have you had a Pikachu?
Yeah, got a Pikachu.
So it's basically a Mouse of the Dead.
Pokemon Snap: secretly a horror game is the next headline for Game Scoop.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm still thinking about non-lethal enforcers. It's really good.
We're doing good work today.
Yeah.
Well, you could do Scoop's take on the biggest horror game of the year, Pokemon Snap.
I'm also happy to report that I did beat the first boss in Returnal.
I'm in that
second biome.
No small feat.
So that's good.
I'm excited to hear what you think about the second boss, because I think that's the one that everybody has this really cool build up, or maybe it's the third one, but you'll know when you get there. There's one that has a really, really cool build up and cool audio moment that like I want to get your take on.
Is that the one where there's like a big like plot twist, I guess? I've heard about that. So at the end of Act 1 is apparently something happens.
Not sure on that part, but there's the gameplay ties into the music and the sound in a way that like I think you will appreciate, Damon.
Cool. I like that game a lot, but I sort of gotten distracted by Resident Evil Village. Although I've been having problems with my PS5. I've been having the problem where I put it into rest mode and it will crash while it's in rest mode. So I come back to it and it's off. And when I boot it on, it has to like rebuild its database. And then it chastises me for not powering it down correctly.
Yeah, that's not fair.
So that's super
because it's rude of you, we're going to have to send a report to Sony. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I wonder, that's really crappy because I'm playing on a PS5 and I've had it paused for a week.
Ooh. You just haven't turned it off?
Yeah, because the PlayStation handles that. Yep. It does the thing.
I've had Resident Evil, because obviously Resident Evil being a game where you actually have to seek out save points and whatnot. So occasionally I'll pause somewhere, especially because I'm playing with a friend, quote unquote, which just means we're on FaceTime and she watches me live stream on Twitch at the same time, which is great because there's a 9-second delay. So I'll freak out and she's just like trying to have a conversation. And then 9 seconds later, when I'm calmly going through some puzzles, she's freaking out. So it's a pretty good cadence we've got going on. Nice. But because I'm on her timetable and my timetable, I occasionally have to pause just in the middle of a really random, creepy spot. So boy, would I be upset if, fortunately I'm playing on Xbox Series X, but it hasn't happened to me yet. Hmm. So hopefully that doesn't.
I've had the PlayStation thing happen to me before, so I don't want to discount that. But the Xbox has been really stable for me for that. Like just turn off the system with the game paused and it starts, you know, immediately right away. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And I forgot to mention, Capcom says they've already shipped 3 million copies of Resident Evil Village. And Capcom is unique among developers, and they are completely transparent in their game sales. You can find it on their website. You can find a list of their best-selling games of all time. So assuming they sell those 3 million units, that puts it right equal with Devil May Cry 4. in terms of units sold and just above the PS3 version of the Resident Evil remake.
Interesting. Across
all number consoles. 22 in their best-selling games of all time. Still have a ways to go to make the 17 million copies that Monster Hunter World has sold.
Ooh, man.
Yeah.
Didn't I read somewhere that Capcom had their best financial quarter year ever in the company's history or something like that, mainly thanks to the strength of Monster Hunter?
That sounds right. But I think we also heard that about Nintendo recently, too.
Yeah. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. I don't know. I think it was Capcom. Anyway, I mean, well done to them for like turning things around and not going the way that many other sort of mid-tier Japanese developers did.
Where does 7 end up on this list? I don't see it, actually.
Maybe they have. I don't think they update that website very often, actually.
No, I'm sorry. It's their second best-selling game of all time.
Oh,
right on. Not right under. So Monster Hunter World, 17 million. Resident Evil 7, 8.5 million. It's like that's the valley between those two games.
Man, Resident Evil, I mean, all in all, that is more successful than I expected it to be and that I now would have expected it to be. It's interesting.
Well, I mean, think about, so it's like Capcom is one of the biggest, most well-respected, longest-running video game developers of all time. Their second best-selling game is 8 million units, you said, Damon?
8.5 million, yeah.
Like, Nintendo trips over themselves and sells 10 million copies of Ring Fit. Mm-hmm, like, yeah. Not that they don't deserve that success, but it just really shows how on a different level the Nintendo is and the Switch is, where they have multiple 10 million selling games on that platform alone.
This episode of Game Scoop is brought to you by NordVPN. As Scoop Nation knows, your Omega Cops have been a little obsessed with a movie called Weekend at Bernie's lately. But as happens too often these days, it is difficult to find it streaming here in the U.S. That's where NordVPN comes in. With NordVPN, you can switch your virtual location to a more enlightened region where they appreciate the comic delights of Weekend at Bernie's. And it's not just for streaming movies and shows. Switching your virtual location can allow you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, and subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price. And you can do all this worry-free as NordVPN threat protection features protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites. Best of all, NordVPN costs the price of a cup of coffee a month, and one account can be used on up to 6 devices. To get the best discount on your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/gamescoop. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/gamescoop. You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get. Except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. Let's check back in with the listeners. A specific listener, Adam from Houston, Texas, and to remind everyone, he said, today I thought it would be fun to make a list of video games that were monumentally improved for their sequels, and also games that took a noticeable step back. The first list was quite easy, as many sequels are significantly better than their predecessors, such as Sonic the Hedgehog, Portal, Mass Effect, Uncharted, Half-Life, Halo, Assassin's Creed, Street Fighter, Mega Man, many others. I found it difficult to think of sequels that were noticeably worse than the first installments, but came up with Zelda, Star Fox, Devil May Cry, Star Wars, Force Unleashed. I did the same with movies and found the results to be the exact opposite, although there are certainly some examples of the sequel being markedly better, such as Empire Strikes Back, Godfather 2, Superman 2, Lethal Weapon 2, Terminator 2. I don't agree with Lethal Weapon 2, by the way. Why do you think that is that most movie sequels are not as good? Why do you think that video games are so good at improving the second installment into a series, yet movies tend to swing and miss quite a bit? Tina?
I mean, oh, thank you. Well, the most obvious answer, I suppose, is the fact that iteration is a core philosophy to developers, and then not to mention the tools that you're using are inevitably advancing over the years as well. So you'll spend, like, several years in development on on Mass Effect 1, and you get the Mako that you get. And then when you're working on Mass Effect 2, you have improved tools, or you have like a good amount of feedback from a release to kind of prioritize, okay, well, this is what worked really well in the first game, so let's double down on that. And then we have these new tools to polish this other stuff. We've brought on like the you know, these new hires to help work on vehicle transport in particular, because that was a weak spot. Like, you're able to evolve across like your staff, your priorities, and your tools when you've gotten a hit and there's some like actual public feedback to operate off of.
Yeah, and I think that I'm not into accepting this premise on its face, by the way, because I think there's, you know, good and bad sequels all over the place. But for movies and games, there can also be cash grabs, right? And that's when things like move quickly. They don't think about, you know, who made the game or what made it special, or they don't think about, especially for movies, you know, what made it special. And maybe that movie is good because it has a self-contained story. And what happens when things have self-contained stories that wrap up really nicely? Mm-hmm. It's hard to put a sequel on the end of them. And yeah, when they're shoehorned in, that's a problem, right? If they're not set up to continue the story, then it generally runs the risk of being bad. And movies are all about stories, whereas games can be about a lot more than story. They can be fun for all different ways. I wanted to give an example of one of my favorite, just totally dropped balls for sequels. It is the, you know, potentially greatest game of all time. I have two of them. Super Mario Brothers has Super Mario Brothers 2, which we call the Lost Levels here. Terrible game. Just awful, you know, it was just a cash grab, quick, you know, variation, basically a DLC pack of new levels that were bad.
And you're talking about the Japanese Super Mario Brothers 2.
Yeah, exactly. And I like Super Mario Brothers 2 US. That's a pretty fun game. I mean, I'm not going to comment on whether it iterates on there wasn't the intention of that game to iterate on Super Mario Brothers. The other one is Tetris, because there was a Tetris 2 right after Tetris.
Yeah, that's right.
Nobody remembers it. They decided not to use the same blocks and everything's crazy. And, you know, it's just really funny. So those are like two of the most monumental, important games of a decade. And their direct sequels were just completely like, let's get something out there and not think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jason.
Well, I think both of you touched on sort of where my head is at on this topic, which is that, you know, games, obviously movie technology improves too. You have, you know, new cameras and new special effects, but it's not as reliant on tech and tech pipelines like game development is, where, you know, you get to build on the engine that you built for the sequel, and you don't have to spend years and years and years working on that game engine and working on that tools, because now you have them, and now you just get to focus in on the experience that you're making for the player, which, you know, the film industry is not quite like that. And like Sam touched on, you know, games are not just story sequels, they're also gameplay sequels, and get to build on and iterate on gameplay ideas. And we couldn't do dual wielding in the last game, or we couldn't do co-op in the last game, and now they get to build on the gameplay and not just the story they were telling. Like, I think if you were probably to just look at stories in games, like, the hit and miss ratio probably does look pretty similar to the hit and miss ratio in film. But once you take a game as a whole, with the graphical advancements and the gameplay enhancements and, you know, whatever they can add on to multiplayer and modes and functions, like, that's when game sequels start to look up more favorably, compare more favorably, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And then in contrast, too, you'll have scenarios where there's a long-running franchise and they're capitalizing on all the things that have made the franchise the best that it has been, but you're kind of running out of new and innovative and creative ideas. I think that comes with what Sam was saying earlier, too, like the success of something kind of necessitating the next sequel. So, you know, I don't know how many Saw movies we're at right now, but I, you know, it's just been diminishing returns from the first novel idea of a Saw movie. And it's just become this like cash grab of shock and gore appeal. So I think at a point of time that happens to video games too, where they've kind of run up against, okay, we've kind of done everything that we can in this franchise. Yep. And then Assassin's Creed will randomly surprise you with a Vikings chapter or something.
Like they have to, the business necessitates sequels, and maybe there's still gameplay ideas to mine there. Like the example that's in my head is Halo. Like, I love the Halo games. It's one of my favorite franchises of all time. The story has become nonsense because it's been stretched past its breaking point. And but I still like they're making new multiplayer maps and they're still innovating in the gameplay, like, you know, new weapons, new gameplay. They're going open world now. Like, that's why I'm excited about that game. But they have to twist and break the lore because the game is required to have a story or premise of some kind. And I don't know. It's a little bit unfortunate. Like, I wish it didn't all have to be equal levels of canon. And like, look, these are all just separate adventures of Master Chief, and they don't necessarily have to build on the, you know, 11 novels and 7 games that have come before. Assassin's Creed is actually another good example of, like, it's exploring really, really interesting gameplay and game design spaces, but then it's forced, each new one sort of gets plopped on top of all the ones that came before, and the tower is getting very rickety now, and just I wish it didn't have to be that way.
Yeah, it's kind of why Tales from the Borderlands was so successful, because they didn't they felt married to the vibe of Borderlands, but not married to the particular characters necessarily. Like, you can explore something that exists in its own ecosystem, but has the same feeling. So for movies, let's say the first movie, you know, is just a complete success out of the bat. And now people are trying to recapture that same spirit. That's so difficult if you're trying to emulate almost beat for beat what made the first movie so great. So it's about what the motivation, the intention, the creative process, and the goals are for the sequel.
It's fun to think of movies having a next gen era, because some of the movies we were talking about, Terminator 2, Aliens, those came at the right on the cusp of CG. And people went to go see Terminator 2 because it had crazy cool CG in it, you know, pooling metal and morphing faces and stuff like that. And like that was kind of a reason to go see that movie, even though it also is a good story and everything's lovely about that movie. But, you know, we haven't really had an era like that. I think they tried to push that with Avatar and 3D at the time. And, you know, like, I don't know if we're going to ever have like a leap in storytelling that was that stark between like 90s tech and 80s tech. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. The movie Predator is a perfect film, in my opinion, perfect sci-fi action film that did such cool things with world building and creating this unique new alien character that lives by its own code and all that stuff. Predator 2 sucks, because all they did is just take that same movie and put it in a city instead of the jungle, and they go through all the same steps as the first one, and it's just like it doesn't offer anything new.
It's the same with Die Hard 2.
Yeah, but if Predator and Predator 2 had been video games, I think all of that would be much more acceptable, because of the interactivity. Now you, the player, are in a totally different environment. You know what you've learned from the first game, but now you have to operate in a city instead of a jungle. So it must have something to do with the interactivity of video games and relying less on improving on a story, which is what most movies would have to do to be better than their original.
But we can all agree that to reduce your very good point to a very simple take, that Crysis did not improve by being moved to the city. It was really cool to be in the jungle. It looked really good.
That's true.
Didn't look as good in the city.
This is Brenton in QLD, Australia.
Queensland,
Australia. Says, quick message. I've been listening to the show for nearly 6 years now. I've heard you guys mention roguelikes a lot, but I'm really not sure what some examples are, except Spelunky, but I haven't played that. Are you able to even give up to 30 seconds to define what characteristics make a roguelike for you and what aspects make you enjoy the genre so much? I have already played some without realizing. I think it's challenging platformers like Cuphead, Celeste, and Guacamelee. No, Brenton. Nope. And QLD Australia. No. I originally learned what a Metroidvania is because of this show, and now I'm just wondering if there was an original NES game called Rogue that had a style or gameplay that has been copied.
Yeah,
so roguelikes.
I was smiling because we were just arguing about this in our top 10 roguelike / roguelite meeting. It's one of those things where, like, you think you know what a roguelike is and a Metroidvania is, but then if you start actually getting into the nitty-gritty, it always gets paired back to, like, well, you know, permadeath and randomized levels. And then it's like, well, okay, but to truly be a rogue. So yes, to answer the question, there was a PC dungeon crawler called Rogue that had a top down viewpoint where it was different each time you played. You go down in the dungeon, it was all randomly generated, and I think in Rogue your character was even pretty randomly generated. And so then games that were copies of that were called roguelikes, just like FPS games are called Doom clones for a little while before first person shooter sort of replaced that term. But now the word roguelike has kind of lost all meaning because so many game developers have taken some of those gameplay ideas and applied them to other genres. So there's platforming roguelikes and shooting roguelikes like Returnal, but maybe they shouldn't be called roguelikes anymore just because they have random level generation and permadeath.
Yeah, so all these modern games, Returnal, Spelunky, Spelunky 2, Dead Cells, Rogue Into Legacy, yeah, Into the Gungeon, all this stuff.
Hades.
Which one?
Hades.
Hades as well, yeah, of course. Most of them would probably be considered what we call rogue lights, but we end up just calling them roguelikes. Rogue light is the term for games that do carry some sort of permanence from run to run, and your character or whatever is improving some way, and you're not completely starting from scratch, although Spelunky is still starting from scratch.
Yeah, there's two schools of like, you know, permanent character progression where like you're going to go, die, and then something you get to take back with you when you start over. Or in like a really hardcore roguelike, the only thing you take back with you is your knowledge of like, oh shit, now I know that like this will kill me. Like now I know for next time, like how to get, like it's just your skills are improving and the game doesn't necessarily have to change. Like, you know, and Spelunky obviously comes from that school.
Yeah.
NetHack is the best roguelike, by the way. Just throwing that out there.
NetHack. Forgot about that.
I haven't played that one.
That's the one where you're the little at. That's the ASCII one.
Oh, I thought Rogue was the ASCII one.
They're both ASCII ones, I should say. And Rogue is actually still, there's some group where, I don't know why they get to have ownership of it or control of it, but there's some NetHack group that like protects and shepherds that game. And it's still being updated. Like they've been making new NetHack updates for like 30 years. Like every couple of years, a new version of NetHack comes out and they're like, we added 35 more enemies.
Yeah. The thing to take away from what Rogue did, which was interesting to people, is the random level generation. The other features of it are kind of in support of that, right? Like if you're going to randomly generate levels, you might as well make that a replayable thing that's interesting. So permadeath is kind of an extension of that. But what I was going to say is that that tech to randomly generate levels was developed so early for that because it was ASCII, like it was just characters. It was, you know, at signs and the letters and stuff to imitate, you know, graphics. And you can think like that's easier to generate than something graphical. So then it went into 2D platforming graphical generation, which was I remember being really impressed by. Like Spelunky was super impressive to me. And remember, it had an iteration before it was even pretty Spelunky. And then now Returnal is a really graphically intensive 3D, you know, generated game. Like that technical progression is cool because it takes AI. It takes a really complex system to make sure that, you know, basically the game is self QAing, you know, the levels that it makes, and it's not going to permanently break and screw you. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. We should probably name drop games like Diablo here, which are not, they do have randomly generated levels and they are dungeon crawlers, but they don't have permadeath. So, you know, there's varying strands of gaming DNA that sort of spiraled off of, you know, games like Rogue and other roguelikes in interesting ways.
And as for, you know, what aspects make me enjoy the genre so much, the best roguelikes are just, you know, pure gameplay, pure game mechanics that are enjoyable to play over and over again, as opposed to a game where you play like Resident Evil Village, you play through the story, comes to its conclusion, you're done, move on to the next thing. A roguelike is a game in the classic sense of the word that you just play over and over again. Like if you like chess or Monopoly or golf or baseball or basketball, you don't play one of those games one time and move on. Like you
beat basketball.
Yeah. You play them over and over again. And each time you start from zero.
That's how I think of sports already. I played it once.
Chess is a roguelike, I would say.
Yeah.
I probably beat baseball in like third grade.
This is Jake Johnson in Columbus, Ohio. Says, the Mass Effect trilogy were some of my favorite games ever, and I'm super hyped for the re-release on the current generation of consoles. My question is, has any remaster, not remake, ever been as hyped up as Mass Effect Legendary Edition? Probably
remaster Super Mario remake.
Super Mario 3 All Stars.
That's up there.
Wait.
Threw me.
The idea here is that it's the most hyped remake of all time.
It's not a remake.
So
if it was remake, I would have been like, oh, tons, like Final Fantasy VII and Shadow of the Colossus and all the Resident Evils. And does Tony Hawk count? That's a remaster, right?
Ooh,
yeah,
that's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, there's a lot of remasters that have come and gone that I didn't maybe pay attention to, but I think there was a lot of hype about them and people liked them. I mean, Last of Us had one right away, right?
The Master Chief Collection, too, although it flopped immediately, but it had the hype going in.
Yeah, it was hugely hyped going in. God, I forgot what a debacle that was. And kudos to Microsoft and 343 for, you know, sticking it out. We run into the same thing we've talked about on Scoop a lot of, like, drawing the line between a remaster and remake. But, like, you know, Crash and Spyro had huge hype behind those games coming back out and being revived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Super Mario All-Stars.
Is Mass Effect out tomorrow? Is it already here?
Yeah.
First of all, All-Stars is definitely a remake. We keep on mentioning it.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah, the original, not 3D All-Stars.
Yeah. Not 3D All-Stars. Yeah, 3D All-Stars, I'm sure, was much hyped and then also didn't live up to expectations. That seems to be a theme. A collected game, you know, a collection of games that looks really nice when it comes out again that people don't like.
It's out tomorrow, Damon, I believe, right?
I guess so. It just snuck up on me. I'll finish Resident Evil first.
Yep.
This is Lance from Tallahassee, and he's 35. I'm hearing some noise. Is anyone else hearing the noise?
Yes.
No. Do we know that that's coming from? Now it's gone.
No, it seems fine now, but I don't know what it was.
Lance is 35 from Tallahassee. Me and my boys, who are 8 and 5, listen to GameScoop every weekend while we're driving and doing our normal weekend activities. Just regular ass weekend activities. Sometimes they complain when I put it on because talking is boring, but their eyes light up and their ears perk up anytime they hear certain keywords, Mario, Minecraft, Pokemon, or Fortnite, to name a few. I asked them if they'd want to ask you a question, and this is what they came up with. So Liam, age 8, asks, which do you prefer more in games, fiction or real? Do we mean like realistic settings or like fantasy sci-fi settings?
I think that's a good take.
Settings like how we ask in 20 questions. So
yeah.
I think I'm more of a fictional sci-fi or fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I specifically seek out those experiences. I've talked before on the show that I don't like playing games that are about like being in the army.
Hmm.
Like, I don't like games about that. It just doesn't appeal to me in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely.
But space armies.
Yeah, space army.
All in.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I'm like 50-50 because all I've been playing lately is Yakuza games, which are set in, you know, they're fictional cities in Japan, but based off of real settings. You know, but then obviously I've played many sci-fi and fantasy games as well. Which you know, that's also the genre of books that I read is a lot of sci-fi and fantasy as well. So guess I'm just a big old nerd that way.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And then Emmett, age 5, asks us, what is it like to test a video game? It's probably not accurate to say that we test video games. We do sometimes. Like, yeah.
There's three definitions of that. It'd be, you know, a preview of a game is kind of like testing it because it's an unreleased version. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, like, the actual definition for testing would be QA for quality assurance. So that's when you're actually doing the testing. And everything I hear about it is not nearly as fun as it sounds on the surface, because it's a lot of playing the same 30 seconds of a level over and over and over again to make sure that bug is gone or you found all elements of that bug. Like, it's really about bug research more than it is about playing a game for fun and writing notes down about that game. And then I suppose, like, you know, we touched on this, I think, on another Scoop, but like consultancy would be another version of testing a game, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I assumed that the question was about reviewing games is how I took it. And that's the same way I explained it to my daughter. It was like, yeah, we sometimes get to play video games early and then we get to tell people whether we liked it or not and whether it's good video games are kind of expensive. And so it's people's jobs to let people know if they think that other people should buy that game or not. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun, and I can't imagine doing anything else to answer the original question.
There's definitely an excitement that comes with getting to play a game that isn't out yet, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was like a huge motivator for me to get into this business, was going to E3 and getting to play games early.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's still super fun, although it's after 15 years, maybe doesn't feel quite as special anymore, but, I don't know. It's nice. I feel very lucky that like my main hobby I get to make a living at.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Yeah. I used to love previewing games, 'cause it felt like you were like part of this special group and you got access to see this thing and experience this thing before anybody else. Mm-hmm. But after a while I realized that I would play a preview of the game and then it would just end up being me playing that same 2-3 hours over again when the game came out.
Yeah.
So yeah, it ended up being like, no, wait for the full thing to come out. I don't mind playing early.
There's definitely like playing it at a show and then playing a preview build and then the retail build comes out and trying to blast through it again. Like it's not as glamorous, like many things in life, probably. Where like that seem glamorous on the outside, it's actually just kind of can be a little bit of drudgery sometimes.
You know, sure, but that reminds me. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to point out, I also do kind of like though if I've previewed a game or played a game early, when I finally get the final version, you do kind of feel like an expert in it. At least in those first couple hours, you're like, I know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That reminded me of a cool thing about Resident Evil. That the demo that I played, I only played one of the two demos, called Maiden, is a spin-off game that takes place in the mansion and you're like escaping from the dungeon as a different character. It's super cool. And you replay through that whole part of the game later when you're playing, just like the castle part of it. Right. And you kind of play it backwards. And I thought that was a really cool way to play to do a spin on that. I wish previews were customized like that for the reason you just mentioned. And then I wanted to add one thing, is that my take on reviewing a game or previewing a game is a little different. It's exciting, but it's also not all fun. It means that I'm taking lots of notes. It means I'm really thinking about it. And it means like I'm preparing to write about it. And that's, where I'm past, I don't do that all the time with every game I preview now, because I want to play more and understand them and have different contexts for them. But like a big part of like playing a game early usually is like an assignment. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it can be a lot of work.
It can be very, very stressful. I didn't review very many like big AAA games. 'Cause when I was hired at IGN, I did mobile games, but like the few that I did do, it's very stressful and it's a very tight deadline too. Game is repetitive and is intended to be played over a period of weeks or months, but you have to crush that into a weekend, you kind of have to cast yourself into the headspace of like, I'm sick of this game, but that's only because I've had to sit here and play it, for 3 or 4 or 5 days straight. Like, how would I feel if I was playing it for just a couple hours in the evening? Like, maybe it would still feel incredible.
What about taking notes at a convention? That's always stressful when you're like, have your notepad or your iPad or whatever, and you're like playing a game. And you're like, right, playing a game, right. Like, I did that all the time, and it was tough to do.
Oh, it's the worst. Or you're asking, you're on the show floor, and it's loud, and it's someone with a thick French accent telling you about their game, and you're like, oh, God.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of my favorite thing, just because I'm like the notes queen. Yeah. So I'll do an interview, and while I'm interviewing somebody, I'll be writing notes for like follow-up questions or notes about, ooh, I'll write this headline and do this breakout story later. And, crazy amount of multitasking. It's high energy for sure. But there's an excitement to it, like a feeling of productiveness. And then you run over to like the press room, or for us, like our war room, and you quickly scramble and do that story. You hit the next appointment. Like the high energy can be fun for sure.
Yeah.
And those are good journalist moments, right? You feel like a reporter in a movie. It's like you're actually rushing to get a story up. I love that feeling.
One of the closest things we get to field reporting.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Yeah.
Actually, the closest I got to field reporting was, you guys remember the Destiny loot cave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went like on site to confirm like, yes, the loot cave behaves this way. And yes, people are coming and camping out with you. And these are the behaviors. So that was my moment of field reporting in game journalism.
Yeah, you were in the field. You were on, what is it, the Cosmodrome? Is that where it was?
I can picture it.
I forget.
That was a fun day.
Damon, mm-hmm. do you remember when, I don't remember, I think it was like in my filing cabinet. Anyway, we found an old notebook of yours from like mm-hmm. from E3s. And like, you have these, because like, you know, you're writing in shorthand, you're writing for yourself. So you have these insane notes that make no sense. And
I have them around here somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, we were reading off, we played a little game. Maybe we did it on the show. Where we I think were we have done off it, yeah. your notes.
And trying to guess what game it was for.
Guess yeah. what game it was.
Yeah, I have some of those around here somewhere. And I sometimes I think about bringing them out. Oh, doing that. It's we'll do that again sometimes.
My old notebooks are insane.
And that brings us to video game 20 questions. Woo. Our suggestion this week comes from John from Baltimore. Let the questioning begin.
We don't have his age?
No, you don't. Mm. But is John spelled without an H?
Okay.
No, that changes everything.
Yeah.
Is this a horror game?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's Pokemon Snap.
Okay, but that was a hesitancy, yeah, so we got to dig in on that deeper.
Mm-hmm. Maybe... Does this game have monsters in it?
Yes.
Cool.
Was this game made in Japan?
Yes.
It's probably, what's that one Damon loves?
Monster Party?
Splatterhouse.
Splatterhouse.
Is it incredibly gory?
No.
It's not Splatterhouse.
No, it's not that. Yeah.
Is it from before 1990?
No. That's five.
Is it... I'm going to ask this question very specifically. Is it a sequel? Like, because normally I say, is it part of a franchise? Mm-hmm. I would count, if I ask, is it a sequel, it just means it's not the first game. It could be the second.
It's kind of a sequel.
As the spinoff?
That's what I was thinking. Are you asking that, Justin?
Well.
Like, officially?
No, I think it's implied. I'm assuming it's a spinoff.
Okay.
Mm.
Spinoff horror from Japan.
Is it one of those?
Ooh,
weird...
is it? I wonder if it's PT.
Oh, that's super good.
Does the game still exist?
What? What? No.
It's too limiting of a question, I guess.
Yeah, can you play this game? Or,
No.
That was a demo.
Because I want to. Because if it's not that, I don't want to burn a question. Like, well, it should be useful for.
Yeah.
But Damon waffled on, is it a horror game? And PT is very much a horror game.
But maybe he's waffling on the game part.
Because it was a demo.
Well,
it's true.
What I'm picturing are like the action spinoffs of like.
Right. Yeah. So like Lost Planet or something.
Yeah.
Should we go, is there an ice level? We haven't done, is there an ice level in a really long time.
Yeah.
I love that question.
Or a winter, whatever.
I kind of need to get era still, though.
Go for it.
I'm a little worried about that. So is this from before 2000?
Yes.
Okay.
90s game.
So there are games that are set. Oh, is this based on a license?
No.
Okay.
Wait, when is the era? Because didn't you say it's not before 1990?
Yeah.
It is before 2000.
Yeah, so a 90s game.
Did this game
of Kane or something?
Yeah, something like that. Did this game originally come out on a 16-bit console?
No.
Does it have 3D graphics?
No, that's 10.
Could be Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Cool.
Should we specify the monsters?
That matches... Castlevania matches everything we've said so far.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Are there vampires?
Are there vampires? Yes.
Alucard's only half vampire, right?
Yeah, but there's but Dracula's in the game.
Okay, good point. I was gonna say, well, like, you're right, but it's like, I don't think you're actually fighting vampires that much in that game. I think it's just the one.
Yeah.
Did he say yes? I was too busy goofing. is this game made by Konami?
Yes.
There's other Castlevanias.
Wait, hold on. Have we mentioned the specific title of this game yet?
No.
Oh man, that was a good catch. So it could be Castlevania 3 or Bloodstained or...
Well, but it didn't come out on a 16-bit console, and it came out in the 90s.
Yeah.
And it's made by Konami, and it has vampires.
GBA.
Yeah, so it could be one of the GBA Castlevanias.
Circle of the Moon, Aria of Sorrow.
Yeah, and there's a third one. Order of Ecclesia, or is that on the DS?
That would be
It's Circle of the Moon.
None of those would have come out in the 90s.
What?
There's a third one, but I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, you're right. None of those are 90s games. So wait, it could be Kid Dracula on like the Game Boy.
No. Aria of Sorrow and and Circle of the Moon are. Is this a Game Boy Advance game?
I don't think.
No.
The GBA didn't come out until... When did the GBA come out?
99, I think.
It's late. I was going to say, I think most of those Castlevanias are like 2000s games.
Do we want to ask if it's of the franchise, Castlevania
franchise?
Yeah,
please, please.
Reminder that it's probably a spinoff, but
go ahead, sorry.
Okay, I just wasn't sure. I don't want to burn a question, guys.
No.
Is this in the Castlevania franchise?
It's Kid Dracula.
It's cool.
I think maybe technically, yes.
All right.
That's 15.
Is this a chibi game?
Yes.
All right, is it Kid Dracula?
Yes.
Nice.
Kid Dracula.
That's awesome.
Game Boy.
I love that opening screen.
Look at the color.
This is the Famicom version, but I was thinking of the Game Boy version, which was kind of a remake and a sequel.
But it was called something else, right?
No, it was called Kid Dracula.
It was? Okay.
I only ever knew... I mean, maybe we talked about this on Scoop. I only ever knew it as a Game Boy game.
Yeah.
My mind's blown that there's an NES version.
Justin, the newer Castlevania collection that I reviewed. And it's really interesting. It's like a super cutesy Castlevania. But the best thing is that they take the minor scale music that sounds like scary Dracula tones, and they switch it to a major scale and make it sound like this fun circus music, and it's the same melodies. It's so clever.
I'm talking about this now. That's really great. Kid Dracula.
Wow, that was almost a hard mode one. I'm impressed.
I knew that was... I thought that would be a little obscure, but Justin
we had 5 questions left, so we did pretty damn good. Yeah.
I don't think we've ever done... Have we mentioned the specific title of this game before?
I wanted to get that in before we mentioned a couple others. Like, well, it could be this and it could be that, and then confuse us. So I don't know this one.
We got to throw them all out. It was so smart.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Tina was the MVP by getting horror on question one.
Horror on question one helped too.
It worked out well. I sensed like a level of from Damon of like, what? Why are we there already?
Well, I think you're getting better. You're playing the meta. You're playing the meta game.
Yeah, I am. You know.
That's good. The Game Boy Advance was released in 2001.
That's what I thought, because I always associate it with the thing that sticks in my brain is Metroid Prime and Metroid Fusion coming out on the same day.
And that would have been like really early in the Game Boy life cycle, right?
2002 or maybe 2003.
Yeah. The thing that confuses me is I remember my sister getting one, and she's a lot younger than me. And I was like, I just remember living in the house with her playing it, but I had moved out by 2001.
Oh, confused. Hey, back home doing laundry.
Yeah, that's exactly what was happening. 1,000%.
If you're anything like me, you were in college and poor, and you were sneaking in. I was stealing food from my parents. I was like, I'm going to take this can of beans and rice from their pantry.
The laundry thing was real.
Thank you for reminding me. I've been tasked with doing laundry today, so I do need to do that. But that is all the scoops that we have for you this week. Remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@ign.com. John from Baltimore, do not at Sam. Thank you to Sam, Tina, and Justin. Thank you to Mariah working behind the scenes, making this episode possible. My name is Damon. This is IGN Gamescoop. And we're out.
School's out!
Forever.
Down the teachers!
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.